Welcome to Two Way Street. On today's show, we're going to talk to two singer-songwriters who are part of the rich community of musical artists who live and work in Nashville, one of the great musical meccas of this country. They took different paths to come to Nashville, one from the Pacific Northwest, the other from a Southwest Texas agricultural community near the Mexican border. One, Radney Foster, made the journey to Nashville years ago and is now a successful and well-established singer and songwriter. The other, Sylvie Davidson, along with her musical partner and husband, is a more recent arrival. She's finding her way in the vibrant Nashville scene now. What they share in common is a love for country music, even as they both acknowledge a wide range of influences and musical tastes. And if you long to make it in the world of country, you have to find your way to Nashville. For the past couple of months, Sylvie and Radney have been working here in Atlanta. They came to perform in a musical that closed last week at the Alliance Theater. We'll talk a little bit about that later in the show. Because I've loved country music since I started listening to the Grand Ole Opry as a high school kid growing up in Skokie, Illinois, and because I've always been intrigued by the Nashville music scene, I invited Sylvie and Radney to record a show in the Two Way Street Performance Studio just before the run of their play concluded. I began by asking Radney about his early years. You were born in Del Rio, Texas, which is way down there on the Mexican border.
Yes, sir, it is.
Right?
It is not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. And it is Southwest Texas. It really is. Was a very Western world. You know, I had neighbors and friends who, you know, trailered their horses every morning to drive 40 miles to the ranch to work. You know, a lot of sagebrush and cactus.
Your father was a lawyer.
He was.
What kind of lawyer?
He was a small town lawyer, which is a jack of all trades, whether it was probating a will or getting a kid out of jail who got caught with two joints in his back pocket. And in the 1960s, that was a big deal. So kind of a little bit of everything. If, you know, when I saw To Kill a Mockingbird and I saw Gregory Peck in that seersucker suit with those horn-rimmed glasses, I was shocked because I was like, well, that's my dad.
He also was a musician.
Yes, he was. He was a great singer and a guitar player, and he was a terrible guitar player. But he played enough to you know 8 or 10 chords, and on any given Saturday night that I really remember, somebody brought the barbecue, somebody brought the potato salad, somebody brought the beer, and everybody brought an instrument, and they played music all night long.
This was in the 60s.
Yeah, and you know, they would play everything from a Hank Sr. song to that new song by that Puff the Magic Dragon by that Peter, Paul, and Mary group. You know, I mean, it didn't matter whether it was Fats Waller or, you know, a show tune or a country song or a folk song. If it was simple to play and they liked it, they would play it.
So listening to your father and his friends play really inspired you. How old were you when you picked up the guitar? Do you remember?
Probably about 10 or 11 years old.
Yeah.
Picked up my father's guitar.
Sylvie, did you have musical influences in your family growing up, or did you pick up the guitar on your own?
My parents were really supported my brother and I in getting us into the arts in all different ways. So we took art lessons outside of school, and I took dance lessons, and my brother started playing piano when he was pretty young. And when I was 6 years old, what I remember, and I'm sure this isn't correct, but what I remember is my mom saying, "Do you want to play piano or guitar?" I think she probably meant or any other instrument, you know. But I heard piano or guitar, those are my options. And I didn't want to play the piano because my brother had been playing for 2 years and I'd have to play the baby songs that he had already played. So I chose guitar.
You know, it's interesting. You two come from such different geographic homes. Del Rio, Texas, yeah. At the Mexican border. Kitsap Peninsula?
The Kitsap Peninsula.
Peninsula, which is basically suburban Seattle?
Yeah, definitely. My dad commuted on a ferry boat for 30-plus years to Seattle to work. But it's just west across the Puget Sound from Seattle.
So, Radney, when I think about your growing up, you made a record called Del Rio, Texas, 1959, mm-hmm. honoring the year you were
born. When and where I'm from. And I did it because that album was, I think, I had been in a band called Foster and Lloyd, and we were, as much as we were a country band, we were a punk band. We were really part of that whole cowpunk thing that was going on in Austin, Los Angeles, and Nashville. And it was really cool because we would be, you know, playing one weekend with George Strait and the next weekend with Roy Orbison or Neil Young or, you know, or with other, you know, on festivals with people like R.E.M. and Husker Du. So it was really a disparate thing. And my first solo record, I kind of wanted to prove that I really, honest to God, loved country music and could make a stone cold country record.
I think I'm correct to say that the real breakout song from that was Just Call Me Lonesome.
Yes, sir. That first one was, and then also Nobody Wins.
Well, the reason I think of Just Call Me Lonesome...
Oh, it's a stone-cold country song.
It's not only a stone-cold country song, but it shows your Texas roots.
Oh, yeah,
song.
It's definitely
That's
got
a
that.
Texas
oh,
country
big time.
Song.
It's a shuffle. You can dance to
play
it.
Play a little
sure.
bit, just a little of it.
With my fingers at work, I haven't warmed up. I'll just start with it. Just call me lonesome. Heartbroken and some, 'cause I ain't got no one since you've been gone. You call me baby, now I've got a new name. I don't need my old one. Call me lonesome from now on.
Sylvie, have you seen the video of him singing that song as the very young Radney Foster?
I have not.
Oh, you need to see
I
it.
I will.
We're going to post that on the Two Way Street Facebook
do.
Page
yeah, awesome.
Because you're just a young kid mm-hmm. when the video of that song was recorded.
When I recorded that baby-faced man at that point.
You and your husband sing together.
We do, yeah. We have a duo, and we write songs sort of on our own, and then we also write songs together. And most of the time when we're performing, we perform together, yeah.
Okay, so let's tell a little bit about your journey. You have a lot of credits. You've worked extensively as an actor.
Yes.
Much of your work done back in the Seattle area, but you've done off-Broadway, right?
Yeah, I was cast in a folk music musical about American folk from the 20s through the 60s that started at the Rubicon Theater in California. Mm-hmm. It's called Lonesome Traveler. And then eventually we took it to 59 East 59 theaters in off-Broadway in New York.
Okay, so now we've established where you're both from. And Sylvie, we're going to come back to talk about how you ended up in Nashville. But Randy, let's start with your journey. You left Tennessee to go at the University of the South in
yeah, I left
East Tennessee?
Texas? I left Texas and went to University of the South, Suwannee. It was right up the Monteagle Mountain from here.
Yeah.
Music was a hobby.
What were you studying?
Forestry and geology. I have a degree in both forestry and geology. And
I think I'm right that one evening...
Oh, yeah.
You made a phone call.
Well,
back
more than
to
a phone
Del
call,
Rio.
But here's what happened was that my band was playing up there, and a guy who was not a student there, he was with some alumni friends, and they heard my band, and the guy was kind of lit, and he came up and he said, "I don't know jack squat about the music business, but I got a buddy who's a record producer in Nashville." I'm like, "Yeah, sure." So I write my phone number down, which is the payphone at the end of the hall in the dorm. And so sure enough, 2 weeks later, I get tacked on my door. It says, "Call Brown Bannister." Well, that was a real name of a real guy who happened to be Amy Grant's producer. You know, this new ingenue who was taking the world by storm. And so I called him, and I ended up playing him four or five songs. And he said, "You got to have a serious talk with your folks about doing this for a living." And so... right before I was supposed to go back for my senior year, I woke my mother and daddy up in the middle of the night. And I said, "You know, Mom and Daddy, I got something that's heavy on my heart and I need to talk to you about it." And My mother said, "Oh, good Lord, what is it now?" And I said, "I think God wants me to drop out of college so I can be a singer and a songwriter." My daddy sat bolt upright in bed at that point. And he said, I'm not making this up, exactly what he said. He said, wiped sleep out of his eyes, took the longest breath I've ever heard, and said, "Son, I've known God a long, long time. And he does not want any son of mine to drop out of college to be a singer and a songwriter." He said, "You heard wrong. You're not praying hard enough." You know? So they cut a deal, and I convinced the dean to let me take a year off. And I moved to Nashville for that year and, thought I was going to be the next Elvis by the time I was 21, but nothing happened.
You went back and finished school. Who were the artists you were listening to in Nashville at that point? What year would this have been?
This would have been in 1980. And
Amy Grant. Who were the artists?
The artists that I was really listening to were a lot of singer-songwriters, most of whom had only a peripheral connection to Nashville. The two that I knew had a connection to Nashville were Guy Clark and Rodney Crowell. And I loved both of their music a lot. Certainly I was listening to everything from the Beatles to Buck Owens to Neil Young, and Crosby, Stills, Nash's music had a huge impact upon me. So did Waylon Jennings. I'll never forget buying Waylon Jennings' Honky Tonk Heroes record and going, "Who is this Billy Joe Shaver guy?"
Right.
And also... The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band had come out with a record called "Will the Circle Be Unbroken," which really put them together with these really traditional. That's how I discovered Doc Watson, and then bought Doc and Merle Watson on stage and bought a thumb pick and started finger picking.
The Carter Family is on that. Mother Maybelle is on that record.
On that record. Merle Travis and Doc Watson playing a duet for the first time, meeting each other. I mean, there's so many things about that confluence of country and rock and songwriters that really wanted to make art, that really being an artist mattered. They weren't just trying to be a hit. I mean, those people were all speaking to me, and I was trying to write songs in those veins.
So this takes us, you've graduated now from University of the South, and now you're back trying to make it in Nashville.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Sylvie, here you are working as an actress in the state of Washington, and you and your husband, who have been singing together, decide you want to leave Washington and come to Nashville. What was that all about?
Trevor had met a lot of people involved in songwriters and other people involved in the music business in Nashville. And for years, they'd been encouraging him to come. So he starts mentioning this. And I said, I surprised myself. I said, "I'll go to Nashville with you." You know, it wasn't until I met my husband that I...
Whose name is Trevor Wheatman,
Trevor
by
Wheatman,
the way.
Yeah. Even thought about songwriting as anything other than really personal expression. I don't know. I think it was Trevor encouraged me to be a better writer. I think we do that for each other, and it just felt like the right thing to do. It just felt right.
In the show you're doing at the Alliance Theater, your character at one point says, "I always have a song in my pocket." Do you have a song in your pocket that you and Trevor sing together that you could share just a little of with?
Let's see. I would be singing his part and my part.
There you go.
All right. Who needs a husband? So this is Trevor. If I had a little money, I'd take you out. Someplace nice and fancy, way downtown. And I'd let you get anything that you want. And wouldn't that get you going? Wouldn't that turn the engines on? This me, no, no, my love, don't run on money, honey, time is free. And that's the only thing you need to spend on. My love don't run on money. My love don't run on money, no.
That's an awesome song.
That's a great song.
Thank you.
When you got to Nashville, did you listen to a lot of country music growing up when you were in Seattle?
If I'm going to turn on music on the radio, that tends to be what I listen to. But I was listening really more to Joni Mitchell and Judy Collins and all. I grew up listening to that music. I think that I honestly, like, I mean, Trevor and I are in the circles in Nashville that are, you know, like, we go to open mics, and at this point there are, you know, 5 or 6 venues that know us and will, you know, will let us come and play 45 minutes. So, and in those circles we're meeting people writing songs in all different styles. What feels different is meeting so many songwriters.
I think Nashville as a community, as a songwriting community, you know, you'd be shocked at how many songs are pop songs, you know, that, you know, All About That Bass was written by Nashville songwriters.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's a, you know, there's, that part of the community is incredibly diverse and incredibly encouraging. Whether you're in a rock band, whether you're a folkie, whether you're Stone Cold Country, you know, a kid from Alabama who all you've ever listened to is, you know, traditional country. I mean, it's all over the map in that respect. And that's one of the things I love about that town.
Yeah. And there's a special, I mean, there really is, I think it affects the whole city. There's a energy that comes from that, mm-hmm. you know, you think about a city where truly on any given night, in probably over 100 venues all over the city, there are people getting up from, you know, a 16-year-old who barely has learned how to play the guitar to somebody like Radney who's, you know, saying, here's a song I wrote, putting it out there in the world. And that energy affects a place. I really think it does.
It's always been that way.
Okay, we're going to take a short break right now. And as we do, Radney, let's listen to a song that you recorded with your former partner, Bill Lloyd, back in the 80s. If you're just joining us, my guests are Nashville singer-songwriters Radney Foster and Sylvie Davidson. Radney's had a long and successful career in the country music recording industry. Sylvie is newer to the Nashville scene and is now working to make a name for herself in the business. Radney began his career as a young man trying to write hit songs for established stars. You went to work for MTM Publishing?
Yeah, Mary Tyler Moore. If it hadn't been for Mary Tyler Moore, I might not have a career.
And this was a company that hired people like you mm-hmm. to sit and write songs all day.
Be a staff songwriter.
How did that work? What was the workplace like?
It was not untypical of Nashville and or the Brill Building in New York. And MTM really ran rather old school. They had a songwriters meeting every Monday. And that's where you got your paycheck. You picked up your paycheck there.
And you got paid per song?
No, you got paid per week. You got an advance against future royalties. But it was the only game in town. You would go in on Monday and they'd say, you know, Dolly Parton and T.G. Shepherd and the Oak Ridge Boys are all looking and they're all recording at the end of the month. And people would go into a cubicle and they would write something tailor-made for those people. And it was like cutting heads. Every Friday they had a recording session on what were the best 5 songs out of the company.
So essentially you all recorded demos.
Correct.
That would then be chosen to present to the artists.
Correct. And they might do a demo session on you if you had enough songs together every now and then. But basically every Friday they had that recording session and you wanted to be on it. And I was failing miserably at that. And my publisher, Meredith Stewart, God bless her, who is just awesome. About 6 months in, I thought I was going to get fired because she called me into her office and she said, I don't really like what you've been writing with the, and I, you know, after the songwriting meetings, and I thought, oh God, here it comes. I hadn't been 6 months. I'm going to get fired. And she said, but I love what you've been writing on your own, and I love what you've been writing with Bill Lloyd and Holly Dunn. So well, you just do that.
You and Bill Lloyd, you know, wrote a song together called Since I Found You.
And right? It was the first top 10 hit for a band called Sweethearts of the Rodeo.
Yeah, how'd that go?
Since I found you, honey, I found love. You're the only one I've been thinking of. I don't miss doing what I used to do. Don't miss nothing since I found you. Don't miss nothing since I found you. And it was, they were, and we weren't all that excited about the cut because they had won. The reason they had a gimme record deal, they had to put out one single on these girls because they won the True Value Hardware Battle of the Bands contest and got some cash and got the right to put out a single on CBS Records. Well, we thought, CBS don't, all they're going to do is mail it to the, you know, radio stations. They're not going to care about it. But the A&R guy's like, no, they're really good and we're going to do an EP on them. And so the first single went out and it kind of did okay. And then we ended up having the second single, mostly because the song ended up in a movie with Kim Basinger and Jeff Bridges and called Nadine. That was a romantic comedy out of Austin. And that song was in the movie and started getting airplay and ended up becoming a hit single because of it.
So you've had a fascinating career in the sense that, number one, you've had some big country hits mm-hmm. that you wrote and performed. You've also written for other artists who we all would know. You've written for the Dixie Chicks, for Tanya Tucker. You've written
Keith
for
Urban,
Keith Urban,
Brian, all kinds of folks.
You've written for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Is it as satisfying? The royalties are great, but is it as satisfying to hear one of your songs sung by another artist? Or do you prefer it when it's you performing?
You know, it depends upon the song. There's some of the ways in which I've been successful is that I was writing as I sort of gained a little bit of notoriety. People would come to me and say, hey, will you write a song with me for my record? And so it seems very natural to hear one of those recorded by the person that I wrote the song with. Most of the others have either been because I don't ever go into writing a song thinking about an artist. The only time I did that was early in my career at MTM, and that was why I was failing as a disaster. And my publisher's like, quit going, don't come to the meeting, stop, you know? And so really, I'm just trying to write a good song. Many of the cuts have come because I put a song on a record. The Tanya Tucker cut was a song that was on a Foster and Lloyd record that wasn't a single. And she was like, that's a hit duet, and I'm going to do that with T. Graham Brown.
The big hit for that Keith Urban sang that you wrote, Raining on Sunday.
Yeah,
would you mind playing just a little of it?
Not a problem at all. Well, it ticks just like a Timex, never lets up on you. Said life is easy, the job is never through. It'll run us till we're ragged, it'll harden our hearts. Love could use a day rest before we both start falling apart. Pray that it's raining on Sunday, storming like crazy. We'll hide under the covers all afternoon. Maybe whatever comes Monday, take care of itself, cause we've got better things that we can do. When it's raining on Sunday,
I know you two have kind of got a little mutual admiration society that you've developed. When you hear that voice, Sylvie, how do you describe Radney's voice?
Oh, gosh. It is very, it carries so much emotion, but it does it so specifically, if that makes sense.
And very directly.
Yeah.
And you are a fan of her
singing.
Absolutely. Why? What is it about Sylvie?
There is, I think partly it's the depth of emotion. You always, when she really opens her mouth to sing, you believe it. And then I think also she has a certain soprano quality that can only really, that to me is really cut from that folk meets country cloth that I would put in the vein of, you know, both Dolly Parton and Emmylou Harris. Her use of vibrato is so subtle. You know, oftentimes if a singer has that capacity, they tend to overuse it, and she has control over it and knows how to. It's a weapon that cuts to your, like a knife to the heart.
You want to sing a little for us?
Sure. You're over the moon.
Yeah,
I do.
Sylvie Davidson.
Beautiful. If I wasn't on the radio, I'd be cussing right now. That's so good.
It's a beautiful song.
Man, that's so good.
We're going to take another break now, and as we do, Sylvie, let's listen to a song from you and your husband, Trevor Wheatman. Sylvie Davidson and Radney Foster got to know each other during the run of a musical called Troubadour. It just finished its run at the Alliance Theater last week. The show is set in Nashville in 1951, and it tells the story of people just like Radney and Sylvie, singer-songwriters trying to make their mark on country music. The music for the show was composed by Christian Bush, and the script, to be fully transparent here, was written by my wife, Janice Schaefer. The final scene of Troubadour is set on the stage of the iconic Ryman Auditorium. And in a case of life imitating art, the cast of the show and Christian were invited to perform at the Grand Old Opry at the Ryman in early January. One of the things that was thrilling, I think, Radney, as you worked on this show, was that you were invited to perform on a Saturday night on the Grand Old Opry broadcast.
Yes, sir.
On a night that the Opry was at the Ryman Auditorium, Mother Church of Country Music, and you and Christian, mm-hmm. Sylvie, Zach Seabaugh, who is also mm-hmm. appearing in the show, got to sing songs of your own, in your case, and from Troubadour.
Correct.
First of all, Radney, you've played the Opry many times.
Yes, sir, I have.
Tell us, how special is it to be at the Opry?
It's the biggest honor I've ever had. You have to be invited. You don't just get booked there. And it is really, it's the longest running live radio show in American history.
1925.
Yeah, and every Saturday night. The thing about it is that when you realize who's been on that stage, when you realize not, and then also when it's at the Ryman, which is its original home, when you realize who's been on the stage of the Ryman alone, there's a reason they call it the Mother Church of Country Music. You know, I mean, if the Carter family, Hank Sr., Johnny Cat, Caruso, I mean, it's just an unbelievable historical phenomenon. A good example is that Johnny Cash's television show was all filmed in the Ryman Auditorium. Yep. So when you saw Linda Ronstadt sing on television for the first time in her career, when you saw Derek and the Dominoes play with Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins, crazy, you know, insane variety show, you know, when you saw Bob Dylan and Johnny Cash sing North Country Girl, mm-hmm. all of that was on the stage of the Ryman Auditorium.
So Sylvia, on that Saturday night,
yeah.
you were invited to come out and perform a song from Troubadour.
Yeah.
Your first time on the Ryman stage. Tell us about it.
Oh, it was completely wild. I was really nervous. In fact,
I've never seen her nervous. I was really,
you know, that building has, you can feel the history that it has. I mean, I felt a little,
I think one
like,
of the cool things backstage, and I noticed that she really noticed them, they have all of these pictures of, you know, Minnie Pearl and little Jimmy Dickens and Roger Miller all standing there together, you know, and Eddie Arnold, you know, goofing it up with Roy Acuff in 1949. You know, I mean, it's insane what's all these pictures that are in the backstage.
It was completely amazing. And then I also got to sing harmonies back up for Radney. He asked me to sing, which was really special.
Easy for me to do.
What was the song?
Nobody Wins, which was, you know, one of my biggest hits ever. Mm-hmm. Mary Chapin Carpenter had sung the background vocal parts on that record, and she's a huge Chapin fan.
Mary Chapin Carpenter fan.
Would you two be willing to share that with us?
Sure. You say this ain't over yet. I've said things that I'll regret. Won't be easy to forget. Scars take time to heal. Before another bitter word gets loose, I was hoping we could call a truce. Nobody wins, we won't lose. Hearts get broken and love gets bruised. When we light that same old fuse again and again. Nobody wins, slamming doors. We've all lost this fight before, and I won't play that game no more, 'cause nobody Darling, we got too much pride. It don't matter who's wrong or right. Honey, love ain't black and white. The way I feel about you, all I wanna do is hold you tight. I can't take another angry night. Nobody hearts get broken and love gets bruised. When we light that same old fuse again and again. Nobody wins, slamming doors. We've all lost this fight before, and I won't play that game no more. Nobody
Radney Foster, Nobody Wins, your biggest hit. Thank you. It's Sylvie Davidson singing harmony. So Christian has told me that we can share a couple of songs from the show. He's perfectly fine with that.
Great.
Would you sing a song from the show for us to send us out? And then Radney, I think you know what I'm going to ask you to sing. So here's Sylvie Davidson singing a song of her own choice from the show Troubadour.
I'm gonna do Plain and Simple. Plain and simple, it's not
Sylvie Davidson singing.
Just wow.
As Inez Miller, the young girl from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, comes to Nashville to become a songwriting star.
That lyric always kills me. Mama got my first breath, yeah. The Lord gets my last breath, and you can have the ones in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
Dadgummit Christian Bush.
So the title song of the show is, of course, Troubadour, Radney.
Yes, sir.
Christian has said that you sing this song of his so well that he's basically given it to you.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that I think one of the things that drew me to this song and to the entire play was that, you know, the context of this song, the song really is that if you're a singer-songwriter, the best that you can hope for when you're gone is that someone will remember one of your songs.
Tell the audience briefly the context of this song.
Well, the context is that Billy, no spoilers, but Billy has basically is being forced to retire and has, you know, pretty much run off everyone around him who, with his anger and his bluster, he's really going through the stages of grief, and it's his first admission, I think, to himself and to God that he is not going to make it, and that the only thing that he could hope for is that someone would remember the songs. And the beauty of it is that the scene is in such a way that Billy has the gift and ability to sort of have just a song pour out of him. And so you watch, as an audience, you watch Billy write the song.
Billy Mason on the eve of his farewell concert at the Ryman Auditorium.
That's right.
Truth's the most beautiful thing.
are weak, it is strong. It's a song. Tomorrow they'll shut the door on this old troubadour. There'll be nothing left when I'm gone. This old case, this guitar, and a song. Tomorrow they'll shut the door on this old troubadour. There'll be nothing left when I'm gone. This old case, this guitar, and a song.
Radney Foster, singing Troubadour. Radney, Sylvie Davidson, thank you so much for being with us today for A Two-Way Street. We're going to post some videos of the two of you singing on our Two-Way Street website so people can watch more of what you're doing. But thank you so much for being here. It's been really a pleasure to have you.
It's absolutely been a joy, yeah.
You'll find the videos of Radney and Sylvie on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS. And if you want to see Radney perform live, he's going to be at the Red Clay Theater in Duluth next Friday night, February 24th. Country music and Nashville's claim on being Music City USA owe a lot to the partnership between the Grand Ole Opry and Nashville's 50,000-watt powerhouse, WSM Radio. In November of 1925, WSM launched a Saturday night show that they first called the WSM Barn Dance. The show's founder and host, George D. Judge Hay, said it would be devoted to homespun music and entertainment. Hay changed the name of the show to the Grand Ole Opry 2 years later. But that very first show in 1925 kicked off with a performance by the 77-year-old fiddle player Uncle Jimmy Thompson. Here he is in an appearance on the Opry a few years later, talking with Judge Hay.
I've got grown grandchildren and great big great-grandchildren. I'm running cars and trucks yet, and I'm playing the fiddle yet. And I love to look at a pretty woman just as good as I ever did.
I bet you do.
Let's
hear that quadrille, woman.
All right, here she comes.
The Saturday night broadcast attracted larger and larger live audiences, and so the Opry changed venues several times to accommodate the crowds. In 1943, they moved to the Ryman Auditorium, which, thanks to the remarkable parade of artists who came to perform, soon became known as the Mother Church of Country Music. Porter Wagoner wrote a song about it.
Countryfied like me, you'd be next to heaven at the Grand Ole Opry. I love you, Church of Country Music. Well, open
in 1972, members of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band brought together a collection of the Opry's early stars to record their classic songs. The album, which is called Will the Circle Be Unbroken, features Roy Acuff, Mother Maybelle Carter, Doc Watson, Earl Scruggs, and many others. It's a treasure for anyone who loves old-timey country music.
Picked one for 15 years, ain't you?
The record opens with a tribute to the Opry, its stars, and the home of country music, Nashville, Tennessee.
Come and listen to my story, if you will, I'm gonna tell about a gang of fellers from down at Nashville. First I'll start with old Red Foley doing the Chattanooga Shoe. We can't forget Hank Williams with them good old Lovesick Blues.
it's time for Roy Acuff to go to Memphis on his train with Minnie Pearl and Rod Brassfield and Lazy Jim Day. Turn on all your radios, I know that you will wait.
That's our show for this week. Our senior producer is the immensely industrious Jenny Ammon. Our producer is the irredeemably irreverent Lisa Clark. I'm Bill Nigut. Hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.
Ernest Tubbs number, two wrongs won't make a right at the Grand Ole Opry every Saturday night. Making his gold tooth and plug hat. Cowboy Copa singing tragic romance. Signed, sealed, and delivered with Sam and Kurt McGee.